All right, let's talk about Islam. As I mentioned to you, September 11th, 2001, I knew a lot more about Hinduism than Islam. And I've been kind of on a crash course ever since to get up to speed on Islamic doctrine, apologetics, history to some degree. I'm by no means an expert, but I have come to some conclusions about the nature of Islam, the essence of Islam, and how Christians should try to deal with Islam. Now, I'm not going to be emphasizing the history or the particularities of Islam. We're talking about approximately 1.3 billion people worldwide. And this millennium will be religiously a contest between Christianity and Islam. If you don't believe me, read Philip Jenkins' book, The Next Christendom. Christianity is growing at a tremendous rate in the third world. It is dying out in Europe. Apart from a miracle, and apart from a revival miracle, I'd say that Islam will take over Europe within 20 to 30 years. No profit on that. Just looking at the statistics, the sociology of it, I don't think secularism can hold up against militant Islam, frankly. Christianity can. I don't think secularism can. We'll see. But Europe is hollowed out in terms of Christian influence. The United States has a lot of sound and smoke and mirrors about Christianity, but in terms of a tremendous, deep Christian commitment to core kingdom values, we're not doing too well, frankly. We do have an influence, certainly. So I think the great contest religiously in this century will be between Christianity and Islam. Islam began quite victorious, and that's in its blood. Muslims oftentimes, when they give an apologetic at all, will say that the quick success of Muhammad and his followers shows that God was with him. And there was tremendous success in Arabia, through Europe, Africa, but in the last several hundred years, and especially since the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire, Islam has been in retreat and has been tremendously flustered and frustrated at this because, frankly, in their worldview, this is not supposed to happen. Islam has no real theology of suffering the way Christianity does. Bernard Lewis has discoursed on this with great profundity, and I can't come close to repeating it, but Bernard Lewis is probably the greatest living Islamic scholar, author of many books, said that Islam is a religion of victory and conquest and territory. And he likes to use the term, which never caught on, called Islamdom. Think of Christendom, Islamdom. Because in Islam, you cannot separate the religion from the politics, from the law, from the culture. It's all of a piece in historic Islam. So Islam is a set of spiritual practices, is a legal system, is a cultural system. It's a kind of civilization, Islamdom. So Islamdom is based on conquest and victory and showing the power of Allah over false gods. But in the last several hundred years, it's experienced a reversal and frustrations. And this is behind much of the modern Islamic rage against the West. Our first indication of this, first strong indication, was the Iranian Revolution with the Ayatollah Khomeini. There were other signs before 9/11. Small things like fatwas issued by Osama bin Laden and others saying that Muslims had a holy obligation to engage in jihad against Americans wherever they found them, to take all of their goods and to kill them whenever possible. For some reason, the Clinton administration never seemed to notice that the Taliban had taken over an entire country, and that country was training terrorists that were going out into the rest of the world, and terrorists that were hell-bent on destroying our civilization. The Clinton administration did exactly nothing about any of this. Mark my words, History will show Bill Clinton to be one of the worst presidents in the history of this republic. When he's dead, when he can't spin anything anymore, when he doesn't have his propaganda machine out there, and the facts start to get revealed, mark my words. That was footnote. In terms of Islam and Christian truth, we've had 1,400 years of controversy, sometimes armed conflict. Christians have had very little evangelistic success with Muslims throughout history. And any missionary who has done work in an Islamic setting will tell you this is the toughest, most difficult work that you can imagine. Because you have an entrenched antipathy towards Jews and Christians. And Muslims believe that Islam supersedes Christianity. And that Christians are polytheists, and that they worship a God who is the product of conception from God and Mary. Moreover, there's a tremendous amount of animosity and antipathy towards the West in general, because the West has been in the ascendancy for the last several hundred years, and it's not been an Islamdom. It's been what they would call a Christendom that has gone to the dogs. And one of the arguments by many Muslims against America is, you're supposedly a Christian nation, and look at how decadent you are. Look at your sexual ethics. Look at your entertainment. Look at your culture. You have no sense of decency, propriety, restraint. And Christianity has not made you a better people. Now, of course, when we think of Islam, we think much about terrorism today. And a lot of language to the contrary, we have to realize that the vast majority of terrorists in the world today are Muslim. It's not a racist, that's not a prejudicial statement, it's simply an empirical fact. The vast majority of terrorists in the world today are Muslim. And the father of modern terrorism recently met his eternal reward, Yasser Arafat. Yasser Arafat was the most frequent visitor at the Clinton White House. But I digress. Yasser Arafat is the father of modern terrorism. And he won a Nobel Peace Prize. Talk about spin. Well, he was with the Clintons all the time. Moreover, the vast majority of religious persecution in the world today is by Muslims against Christians. Not all of it. Buddhists, they're supposed to be so peaceful and mellow all the time. Theravada Buddhists persecute Christians in Sri Lanka. I know, because my friend Ajith Fernando is one of the persecuted Christians. And I get his emails and his letters. And of course Christians have persecuted, and still to some degree persecute, those of other religions. But these are historical facts. The vast majority of terrorists in the world are Muslims, and the vast majority of religious persecution is by Muslims against Christians and others, but mostly Christians. Now, is this merely an accident of history? Or are there reasons for these realities? What significance does this have? Now, to answer that correctly would take far more knowledge than I have and far more time than we do have. But I think we need to keep that at the fore. I'll just skip this next section. We've already certainly talked about it, the importance of dealing with truth. But as I've mentioned a few times on the next page, unlike postmodernists, Muslims believe in objective truth and universal revelation. And Irving Hexham, who I often disagree with, has written nevertheless a very good essay on this, called Evangelical Illusions, Postmodern Christianity and the Growth of Muslim Communities in Europe and North America. And he finds it ironic that with Islam on the move for a variety of reasons, growing in numbers, growing in influence, growing in rage in many cases, it is growing because of its commitment to universal absolute truth. That's part of it. It's a whole civilization it's offering. It's not offering a religious preference. It's not offering a niche to people. And Irving finds this to be ironic in light of the trends in evangelicalism towards softening everything, toning everything down, scaling everything back, not talking about objective truth, not speaking in terms of antithesis, true and false, trying to just emphasize the communal and the artistic and not really having a strong backbone of making and defending truth claims. And he just looks at this in a world kind of global context and says, Muslims who don't even have a real gospel are growing, partially because of their commitment to absolute universal truth and because they have a system of thought that they must adhere to. And evangelicals who have a true worldview based on biblical revelation are not really communicating it very clearly or persistently or insistently. Now, when we try to deal with Islam apologetically, there's a tremendous amount to deal with, and I can only scrape the surface. Basically, what I want to do is discuss briefly some of the fundamental aspects of Islam, particularly relating to its doctrine and how those doctrines relate to the Christian worldview, and some basic apologetic arguments that Muslims make against Christians. Now, the apologetic arguments are only necessary when Islam is vying for allegiance. If Islam has taken over a country, you don't find a lot of religious freedom. You may have noticed that. Even in Turkey, which is something of a democracy, there's not a lot of freedom for Christians. Certainly not in Iran. Certainly not in Pakistan. Certainly not in Indonesia, where within recent years, you know about this, Ralph, because the Riverside sent a mission group there, entire villages had jihads declared against them, Christian villages in Indonesia, such that they had to leave their villages and go and flee up into the mountains and live into the mountains. And they're still suffering from attacks from Muslims in those situations. But nevertheless, Islam does have a kind of apologetic, if you will, a negative apologetic against Christianity. And we should be willing to deal with it head on and not run away from it. Now, I also need to say before I get into some of these doctrines and some of the apologetics, and my good friend Tony Weider, who's a convert from Islam and has done missions in Ethiopia, is here, so I may defer to him a few times for some things. But Tony and I were talking about this morning. I said, I've just had a terrible day, and the last couple days have been terrible, and I don't think it's an accident. Every time I've given any kind of exposition on Islam, critiquing it, it's the kind of spiritual warfare that I have talked about with respect to other worldviews. In fact, in a lot of ways, worse. I feel like the New Age was a piece of cake in some ways, in terms of spiritual warfare, in comparison to this. I preached for 20 weeks at Riverside Baptist Church, and I didn't preach on Islam because I thought we had enough spiritual warfare. My wife basically wouldn't let me. She said, we're doing battle on so many fronts with so many things, I really don't want you to preach on Islam. She was, I think, wise. It's a tough area. Now, think about it. Just back off for a minute from the apologetic philosophical issue and just look at it in terms of the gospel and anti-gospels. All right? And the spiritual dimension of warfare. The battle in the heavenly, so to speak. The battle for human beings who will exist forever in heaven or hell. I read to you from 1 John. He who has the Son has life. He who does not have the Son does not have life. This is the revelation of Christ. Islam denies that Christ is the Son of God. It denies that He died on the cross to atone for sin. It denies that He is Lord of the universe. It denies the gospel in the name of the one true God. It claims that the Quran has superseded the Bible. The Quran is not even human at all. It's the mother of all books. It's the mother, what is that expression? The mother of the book. It always existed with Allah and it was just dictated to Muhammad through an angel. And this book denies the saving work of Jesus Christ. And this is a religion that controls the thinking of about 1.3 billion people in the world. And it's growing. Basically, I think it's growing through these five kinds of reasons. Historically and today. Conquest. The history of jihad, holy war, to take back what rightfully belongs to Allah. And that, by the way, is not just a side teaching of Islam. It's not just something way off in the periphery. That is intrinsic to the identity of the religion. And you can find multiple references in the Quran and multiple references in the Hadith to jihad. And you hear the ever so tolerant and ever so stupefied American press saying that jihad only means the personal struggle within the Muslim to be righteous. That is a secondary meaning, or even secondary is giving it too much justice. That meaning does occur, but historically, in the Quran, in the Hadith, in the culture of Muslims, jihad is very central. And as you read in Corduan about the history of Islam, it starts basically with the sword. Muhammad tried to persuade the Jews and the Christians in Mecca that he was a prophet. And they kicked him out. Right? Basically, that's how it worked. There was the flight away from there to Medina, right? And in Medina, what does he do? Builds up a university? He builds up an army. He's a statesman. He builds up an army. He gets booty. He gets loot from his exploits. And he goes back as the conquering king and takes over and destroys the idols and sets himself up as the ruler. That is intrinsic to the identity of Islam. That it is the power of Allah working through the sword. So you have conquest and jihad, and this continues to take various forms. I was talking to Tony about this morning. It's a type of conquest when a major U.S. university is given $30 or $40 million by an Islamic group to start an Islamic studies program. How can they turn down $35 or $40 million to start an Islamic studies program? And there may be more than just studying going on in the overall agenda. Maybe. You need to think about it. Intimidation is a crucial aspect. The Sharia law claims that if anyone is a Muslim and deconverts, the person can be executed. That's a pretty strong incentive to remain a Muslim. That is intrinsic to the Muslim identity. Once a Muslim, always a Muslim. If you defect, you lose your right to live. So there's the intimidation factor, very strong in Islam. In recent years, there's the immigration factor. Think of France, completely hollowed out of the gospel. Very minor Christian witness. How many Muslims there now, Tony? 6-7 million Muslims in France? You know? The mosque being set up, I believe there, I can't give you statistics on this, but the number of mosques in France and in England are growing, and certainly growing faster than the churches are. So you have Muslims immigrating from their native countries to America, to England, elsewhere, France. Indoctrination is key. Memorizing the Quran, whether or not you even know what it means. And don't think that Muslims view the Quran the way we view the Bible. They don't. There's no human aspect to the Quran, supposedly. You are to memorize it and recite it, even if you don't know what it means. It has a kind of mystical effect on you, supposedly. And another huge factor with Islam, the growth of Islam, is procreation. Muslims are procreating at a far higher rate than most other religious groups. Now, when you look at those kind of factors, and you think about 1.3 billion Muslims, and you think about the fact that they deny the gospel and have a history of persecuting or silencing the infidels, this is a tremendous spiritual battle. Whatever you think about the war on terror, whatever your views are on politics, this is probably the defining battle of Christianity for the next 100 years, I would say, is Christianity and Islam. Let me just skip down to key doctrines of Islam, and then I want to make some comparisons. The ultimate reality in Islam, of course, is Allah. It means the God. It's apparently in Arabic incapable of a plural. It's a Unitarian monotheism. And God is considered to be utterly transcendent, beyond, other. And there are various names for God. The 99 names of God is a saying you hear from many Muslims. There's some debate over what the names are, but Allah is often referred to as most merciful, most just, and so on. But Allah is utterly transcendent. Allah does not commune with His people. In fact, I was just talking to Tony this morning about something I had been noticing and was kind of coagulating in my mind, and he helped me bring it together, is that the Quranic depictions of heaven are missing something that the biblical depictions of heaven have. God. In fact, you have to make a distinction between paradise and heaven. In Islam, heaven is the realm of Allah, and it's utterly unapproachable. It's utterly transcendent in this life and the next life. Paradise is what Allah gives His favored servants. Wonderful palatial homes, beautiful virgins, and so on. But Allah is conspicuously absent in the depictions of paradise in the Quran and the Hadith as well. Very different than a biblical understanding. Yes?
Given that view of Allah, it seems that the Quran argument actually works better for them than it does for us because of the difficulty of explaining God in an actual time.
I don't even want to go there. Sorry. If you want to talk to me about it during office hours, we'll give it a shot. The basic theological problem here, to get into apologetics already, Muslims do not believe we're created in the image and likeness of God. They don't affirm that. We are God's creations, but we're not in His image and likeness. We are His servants. We are His slaves. You know, Islam means submission. And Allah is utterly transcendent. There is no mediator. And so even the Quran itself is a product of Allah, but it doesn't really express the essence or the nature of Allah because that is utterly unknowable. So you have a problem, again, in another way, of the unknowability of the ultimate. How can you even have a revelation if the author of that revelation is completely beyond human knowledge? You have the belief in angels, good and evil, that God has given a variety of prophets, including Jesus, including David, including Moses. But the last prophet, the seal of the prophets, of course, is Muhammad. And the Muhammad received the final revelation, the Quran. You have other holy books, the Torah, the Psalms, the Gospel. And the teaching here is that God gives books to prophets. And so the belief is that Jesus received a book, the Injil, the Gospel. It's interesting because Jesus, of course, didn't write any books. But it's the idea that the prophet comes with a book, or I guess really produces a book. And there's a belief in the Last Judgment, which is on every page of the Quran. Just about every chapter of the Quran threatens hell. It just bleeds out of every section of the Quran. There's paradise or hell based on works, and also on the hope of the mercy of Allah. You don't really know what your standing is. The idea is that good deeds cancel out bad deeds, and if you have 51% good deeds when you die, you should be in good shape, but you really don't know because Allah is unknowable. In fact, Allah is so sovereign and free that He even abrogates things He said in the Quran. There are parts of the Quran that says, don't listen to what was said earlier because I just made it null and void. It's called the doctrine of abrogation. Don't think God when you think Allah. You get in big trouble. Allah is not God. Allah is a false God. The fact that Muslims are radically monotheistic does not mean that they know or worship the God of the universe. It means we share with them this very general category of monotheism. As I mentioned, there's no mediator. There is no atoning for sins. There is rather the balancing of sin and righteousness in the hopes that one will be redeemed in the end. Now, the one fruitful route of salvation for the Muslim is jihad. There's a lot of material in the Quran and in the Hadith about the necessity of jihad, the principles of jihad. And jihad isn't anything goes. I mean, there are principles for jihad, but they could be interpreted pretty broadly in terms of if Islam has been offered to a country and the country refuses, jihad is now allowable. I mean, there's some pretty broad interpretation to it. Cordovan talks about that briefly. But there are principles and so on. But, as I said, Islam is intrinsically territorial and intrinsically a religion of conquest. In order to have a territorial religion of conquest, you need warriors. And you need warriors that have an incentive to win. So you find in the Quran and Hadith a lot of incentive, a lot of motivation to go to war in the name of Allah, that this is one of the most meritorious things you could do. So there's the incentive for the army that is required for the conquests. And you also have the incentive of paradise, which is extremely sensual in the Quran and in the Hadith. Now, the 72 virgins that we hear so much about is actually in the Hadith, but there are references to these wonderful maidens that will be available to those that make it to paradise. And it's really a very male-centered view. Who's in heaven? The men and these beings that I guess are, what, created by Allah on the spot? I think that's the view. Basically, you can't drink on earth. You're limited to four wives unless you're the prophet and you can have as many as you want. But once you get to paradise, you can drink wine and have as many women as you want and have the energy to enjoy them as much as you want, even far more than you would on earth. I'm not making this up. I just read a hadith on this yesterday. Okay? So you've got the incentive for warriors. There's also the belief in divine decrees and a very strong view. I wouldn't even call it predestination, really, but a fatalism. And there are even texts in the Quran that talk about Allah leading people astray and then punishing them for their evil. I mean, it would make the most staunch Calvinist look like an Arminian when you read the Quran. Okay? Now, you have the practices of Islam, the confession of Allah and Muhammad as his prophet. That's the confession. And if you do that sincerely, you're considered a Muslim. There are the five daily prayers facing Mecca, almsgiving, 2.5% to an Islamic charity. That's actually of a profit, 2.5% of your profit. It's a lunar calendar with a month-long fast during the daylight, Ramadan, and one pilgrimage to Mecca. And I just recently read the rigors of what they have to do to go to Mecca. It's not like show up and take some video and leave. I mean, it is very rigorous. It's a book written by Ergun and Emir Kaner called Unveiling Islam. They're converts from Islam. They speak out on it quite a bit. Let me just read a little bit about this. The pilgrimage is the climax of the Muslim spiritual journey. They prepare themselves mentally and spiritually for the trip. Only Muslims are allowed inside the city of Mecca, and all are required to dress in a simple white robe to demonstrate unity. Yet the diversity among the people is obvious. People of all races speak in countless languages. The pilgrims first cleanse themselves before they begin their rituals, and they have to go through a pretty elaborate cleansing ritual before they can even pray. And if they happen to touch a woman before they pray, they have to cleanse themselves again. The first stage begins as thousands circle the Kaaba, that's the big meteorite, the black object, seven times, reciting verses from the Quran and offering prayers along the way. Writer Wolf gives details of the journey. When you first see the Kaaba, if you're a Muslim, you've been praying towards it for years. It's very sweet, and it's very exciting. And people are routinely crying at the first sight of this. This nothing, this simple square building. Unquote. The circling of the Kaaba, however, is just the beginning of the journey. Muslims also run seven times between two hills of Mecca, reenacting Hagar's frantic search for water for her son Ishmael. Finally, pilgrims find water at the well of Zamzam and take a drink, displaying the fulfillment of Hagar's quest for her son's needs. Now immersed in the journey, the pilgrims must yet travel a long way in order to accomplish their duty. They must travel 13 miles to the plain of Arafat, where Muhammad preached his last sermon. Here they stand from noon till sunset in honor of Muhammad's standing in the community. Pilgrims must go to Mina, the site of the sacrifice of Ishmael by his father Abraham, according to the Quran, not the Bible, of course. Here pilgrims throw seven stones, memorializing how Ishmael threw stones at the devil to resist his temptations. Next, pilgrims sacrifice an animal in remembrance of the ram offered in place of Ishmael. Muslims return to Mecca and repeat their circling of the Kaaba and the running of the hills. The arduous journey is now complete. The Muslim has worked intensely for one main purpose, the ultimate forgiveness of sin. So you have to keep working and working and working to try to receive the forgiveness of sin in one way or the other, because there is no mediator. And there's no assurance. Unless you die in a jihad, then your salvation is assured. Your salvation is made more certain if you are involved in a jihad. If you die in a jihad, your salvation is as certain as it can get in Islam. Again, can you see the incentive? Yes. Well, I read correctly from the book. Maybe they made a mistake. Okay, I'll have to check into that. I'm not sure. Yes.
We were talking about that. Much like the Bible, certain things need to be in line for the kingdom to be ushered in according to the Quran. One of them is this kind of universal unification of under the Islamic faith. And so speculation was guys like Abu Mustafa al-Bukhari, guys like that, are taking this jihadist or extreme approach. Because one way to convert is through fear and killing people. And so you correlate that with the incentive to usher the kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
What's going to be that?
Well, there's no kingdom. There's no kingdom of God idea in Islam. There's the rule of Allah. And Allah has rightful rule over everything and every aspect of society. Okay? So, resisting the infidels is part of the duty to Allah. Okay? Let me just make a couple of comments about Muhammad and the Quran. Again, don't view the Quran as the Islamic Bible. It is not written by many authors over a long period of time with various styles and all kinds of narratives covering thousands of years. It's not like that at all. It's a collection of chapters or surahs, supposedly has no human element whatsoever. It was dictated to Muhammad over a period of several years by an angel. Muhammad married a quite wealthy woman, and he had the time to meditate, to reflect, to pray. And there was a tradition of monotheism in Mecca at the time, but there's also tremendous polytheism. And this disturbed Muhammad, and he went to pray and meditate, and he received some kind of a supernatural encounter. And at first, he thought it was the jinn, the demons. And he went to his wife, Khadijah, and she assured him that no, it was not the devil, but that God was revealing truth to him, and Muhammad was God's prophet. This is a well-known fact. It's not made up by somebody. So Muhammad received this and recited it. And supposedly Muhammad was illiterate, although there's some dispute about that Arabic word in the Quran, whether it really means someone who can't write or read at all or just someone who's not well versed in it. Bukhari talks about this in his book, The Prophet and the Messiah. As someone who knows Arabic, I don't. But Muhammad wrote nothing down, but he would recite and people would write it down on whatever was handy over about roughly 20-year period. And at his death, various collections of the sayings were brought together. And there was some dispute as to which ones were, as it were, canonical. And the third caliph, Uthman, was the first higher critic of Islam. And he collected the sayings he thought were right and burned all the other ones. And Muslims are very proud of the fact that they have no variant readings. Well, is it any surprise, given the higher criticism of Uthman? Actually, I think there are some variant readings between some of the Qurans, but not very much. And that's an area where Muslims say that they're superior to Christianity because we supposedly have all these variant readings which make knowing the true meaning impossible, which we've discussed that's not the case. So don't think of the Quran as just their Bible. Okay? Now you have to remember also the Quran cannot be translated, or it's no longer the Quran. It's an interpretation. So basically God speaks Arabic. Arabic is God's language, the heavenly language. And the Quran has a kind of intrinsic power to make you somewhat righteous. So just reciting it, even if you don't know what it means, is considered virtuous.